For you, maybe, Liz said. I mean, sorry, but I still consider you a jackass. Do you imagine you're doing me some big favor by overlooking how unattractive I am and how much you hate my family and declaring your love anyway?
Darcy's surprise was apparent in his widened eyes. A surprise, Liz thought, that served as further evidence of his arrogance.
Tightly, he said, I was under the impression that you appreciated candor. It wasn't my intent to offend you.
How could I possibly want to be with the person who pushed Chip and Jane apart? I know now that you told him to break up with her. And I know you were part of getting Jasper kicked out of Stanford. This idea you have that your judgment is better than everyone else's? That you alone should decide the fates of other people? The only question is if being a surgeon gave you a God complex, or if your God complex is what led to your being a surgeon.
I see, Darcy said. And you believe that I have not only the will to control people's behavior, but also the power?
The facts speak for themselves.
Let me assure you that the idea for Chip to leave medicine and go back on eligible didn't come from me.
You may not have bought his plane ticket to L.A., but I'm sure you influenced him.
And when you suggest that I got Jasper expelled from Stanford.
Darcy's expression was haughty.
Just so I fully comprehend. Was it that he was innocent and I planted evidence on him, or was it that he was guilty but I should have unilaterally decided to let him off the hook?
There are worse crimes than writing an idiotic story.
Darcy scrutinized her face before saying,
Yes, there are.
Even if you hadn't screwed over Jasper and Jane, I'd never want you to be my boyfriend, Liz said. And even if you hadn't just insulted my looks, my personality, and my family, and blamed your interest in me on sex hormones, even if you'd expressed your attraction like a normal human being, I still wouldn't.
She was experiencing a pleasing anger, a satisfying outrage rare in her daily encounters, and she expected him to be experiencing it too. But rather than glaring back at her, he seemed wounded, and a small seed of doubt formed within Liz.
I apologize for misreading the situation so egregiously, he said.
Then, it was such a strange old-fashioned gesture, he basically bowed to her.
Forgive me.
He turned, and in a matter of seconds, without further farewell, he was gone. Immediately, Liz began to question whether she'd imagined the whole bizarre exchange. Still standing on the threshold of the open door, Liz found that she was shaking. Her anger was quickly slipping away, replaced with a growing uneasiness. How was it possible that Darcy, had announced that he was in love with her? If it was at some level gratifying, it was also unthinkable. How thoroughly confused she felt. How rattled and off-kilter. From behind the closed door of her bedroom, Mary called,
Lizzie, did someone just ring our doorbell?
Chapter 109. For the rest of the day, while helping her parents settle in at the country club, while dropping off unexpired canned goods from the tutor at a food pantry, and while discussing final fumigation preparations with Ken Weinrich, yes, Liz had watered the soil the previous day. Through all of it, Liz thought continuously of Darcy. Eating a late lunch on the porch of the country club with Mary and her parents, Liz could hardly follow what anyone was saying. Even when the subject changed from Mrs. Bennet's speculation about why things hadn't worked for Jane and Chip to what Kathy de Burgh would be like. Frowning, Mrs. Bennet said,
I've always found her very strident.
It was Mr. Bennet who was driving Liz to the airport for her flight to Houston, though they stopped first at her sister's apartment to get her bags. Just outside the door of their unit, set on the floor and leaning against the wall, was a plain business envelope with Liz's first name written on it,
Who's that from? Mary asked. And Liz folded it in half, stuffed it into her pants pocket, and said,
Nobody.
Mary made a scoffing sound. Yeah, apparently. The envelope practically thrummed as Liz rode to the airport in the passenger seat of her father's car.
Do you remember when you and Mom are allowed back in the house?
Liz asked as her father merged onto 71 South.
It's 1 o'clock on Friday. You'll need to dump out the ice that's in the ice maker. Don't make a gin and tonic with it.
It's remarkable, isn't it? Mr. Bennett said, that for decades at a time, I've stayed alive without your daily instructions.
The fumigation guys will have opened all your drawers and cabinets for air circulation, Liz said. And the doors and windows, too. But Mary will come over and help close everything. And then, please, will you and Mom both really, really try to keep the house looking presentable for when agents want to show it?
Without checking his rearview mirror, Mr. Bennett moved over a lane and a car just behind them honked.
Relax, my dear, he said. We'll all be just fine.
Do you realize you almost had an accident right now?
Mr. Bennett reached out his arm and patted Liz's knee. In an uncharacteristically serious tone, he said,
Lizzie, you've been a voice of reason amid a cacophony of foolishness. It was very good of you to come home this summer.
Chapter 110.
As soon as she had checked her suitcase, made it through airport security, and found the gate from which her plane would depart, Liz opened the envelope. The letter filled 4 pages of notebook paper, and Darcy's handwriting, which she had never seen, was of medium size and no particular beauty. Inscribed in black ballpoint ink, it seemed to be that of a person making an effort at legibility.
Dear Liz, first off, don't worry that I'll try to persuade you here of what I suggested earlier today. The sooner we can both forget my misguided idea, which you obviously found so repulsive, the better for both of us. That said, I'm compelled to clarify a few points regarding Jane and Jasper Wick. I realize that some of what I say might offend you further, and that's not my intent. But if it's a byproduct of stating the truth, so be it. I was, of course, aware that Chip had fallen for your sister. In fact, his feelings for her seemed deeper than for any woman I'd observed him with before. However, although Jane is always a polite person, I wasn't convinced that she reciprocated his interest. The night of Chip's dinner party, I heard Jane tell you that she didn't think she should keep the bike Chip had bought her because of her doubts about their relationship. Granted, I already didn't think your family was the ideal one for Chip to marry into. I know you won't want to hear this, but beyond your mother's pushiness and preoccupation with social climbing, I find Lydia and Kitty's indifference to basic manners mind-boggling. And remember that I have a sister close in age to them. I didn't think such shallow, pampered egotists existed except on reality television. Which brings me to my next point. Regardless of my reservations about Jane, reservations Caroline shared, by the way, I couldn't have convinced Chip to leave Cincinnati and join the eligible reunion. Frankly, I assume he used Jane's pregnancy as an excuse to do what he already wanted to, which was take a break from medicine. You know your sister better than I do, and I'm willing to concede that I may have been wrong about her feelings for Chip. But if she is or was smitten with him, I didn't see the evidence. Nevertheless, I genuinely like Jane, and if I've caused her to suffer, I'm sorry. As for your accusation that I mistreated Jasper Wick, it's more difficult to refute because I'm not sure precisely what you think I've done. However, I'll tell you the facts, and if you want corroboration, multiple articles ran at the time in the Stanford newspaper. I knew Jasper only by name for most of our time on campus and didn't have an opinion about him. When we were seniors, he took a creative writing class. Again, this is all part of the public record. And he turned in a story written from the perspective of a guy in Sigma Alpha Epsilon. I'm sorry to say that because of the charges eventually brought against him, and because I was part of the Judicial Affairs Board, I had the unpleasant experience of reading this story, and I'm confident it was the worst possible version, if there is any version that's not bad, of frat boy lit. Jasper's crimes against the English language weren't the reason he got into trouble, though. I wasn't in the class. I suspect you'll be neither surprised nor impressed when you hear that the only English course I took in college was to fulfill a requirement. But apparently, the discussion of the story was very acrimonious, and the instructor, who was a woman named Tricia Randolph, sided with students who said they found the story offensive. Ms. Randolph, who had come to Stanford for a 2-year writing fellowship, lived in a ground-floor studio in an on-campus graduate student complex. That night, she returned to her apartment to find that a window screen had been removed, and there were puddles of urine all over the papers on her desk and the keyboard of her laptop computer. People had seen Jasper loitering outside the building, obviously drunk, and during questioning with campus police, he confessed to being the culprit. It was clearly a case of intentional property damage, and there was question as to whether, because Ms. Randolph was black, it was also a hate crime, though that charge was ultimately dismissed. I always had the impression that Jasper saw urinating on Ms. Randolph's desk as a silly prank and viewed himself as a victim of rising political correctness. But to me, his transgression absolutely had a racial component. Whether or not he himself was aware of it, I doubt he'd have been so blatantly disrespectful to a white instructor. Again, though, when the judicial panel voted unanimously to expel him, it was for the property damage charge. Presumably, the sting of expulsion was exacerbated by the fact that it happened a couple weeks before our graduation, thus denying him a college degree. But my take is, if you want to graduate from Stanford, don't piss on people's desks. Clearly, you and I have different impressions of Jasper, and I hope this will shed light on why I'm not a fan. It would be nice to think a person can evolve, but I'm not sure I believe it. In any case, to reiterate what I told you yesterday, whatever the parameters of your relationship with Jasper, you're much too good for him. And please don't think that in making such a declaration, I'm suggesting myself as the alternative. Your opinion of me is abundantly clear. I was tempted to tell you all of this today, but due to the unsettling nature of our conversation, I didn't trust myself to relate the information in a coherent way. While I'm not even sure you'll read this letter, I find the misapprehensions you're under troubling enough that I'm nevertheless moved to try setting them straight. I wish you luck back in New York. Best, Fitzwilliam Darcy.
Chapter 111. Contrary to Darcy's speculation, Liz didn't merely read the letter. She reread it many times, and with each round experienced fresh incertitude and distress. His comments about Jane were not particularly convincing. That he believed his own version of events was plausible, but she suspected that his antipathy to her family had contributed more to the part he'd played in disrupting Jane and Chip's courtship than his doubts about Jane's enthusiasm for his friend. She was unsurprised to learn that Caroline Bingley also had disapproved of the union. It was Darcy's description of Jasper Wick that gave Liz pause. Simultaneously so disturbing and so credible, it matched Jasper's own account in many ways. And yet, was Liz really such a poor judge of character? Was Jasper not merely flawed but racist and truly reprobate? Just as their relationship had too closely and obviously resembled a cliché for her to believe it was one,
Jasper had alluded too frequently to being a jerk for Liz to interpret his allusions as anything except jokes. Wouldn't a true jerk show less self-awareness? As she'd read the letter for the first time, Liz's stomach had tightened, and when she took her seat on the plane, she realized that the uncomfortable sensation was one of shame. The proof was plain that both her rudeness to Darcy on nearly every occasion and her faith in Jasper had been wrongly directed. Accompanying her shame was, on Jane's behalf, a great regret. Because it now seemed that misunderstanding, rather than lack of affection from either party, had been responsible for the collapse of Jane and Chip's relationship. And yet, with Chip filming in Los Angeles and Jane ever more pregnant in upstate New York, a clarification that could have occurred over coffee in Cincinnati appeared logistically impossible. That Liz herself had dismissed Darcy's declaration of love was the one decision she didn't regret, for she could no sooner have accepted his entreaty than she could have accepted Cousin Willie's. She and Darcy scarcely knew each other. The entirety of their interactions had been spent either quarreling or having sex, and in one case, on the evening when they'd each wanted the other person to be on top, both. He had acquiesced. She wouldn't deny that she'd had fun with Darcy, of a confined, antagonistic, and peculiar sort, but surely fun could not be the basis of a relationship. Could it? The plane began to accelerate on the runway, and presently they had lifted off. From her window seat, Liz watched the buildings and rolling hills shrink beneath her, the Ohio River go motionless. The cars on the highways slow to a crawl before vanishing from view. Cincinnati resembled in this moment a miniature model of the sort an architectural firm might create. It didn't seem large enough to contain all the events of the past months. She had wondered, she now realized, if she'd make it out or end up staying forever, trapped by obligation and inertia. Yet it was the very act of leaving that cast doubt on the desirability of escape. Or maybe it was nothing as symbolic as doubt, she thought as the pilot curved south. Maybe all that was being cast was the shadow of her own plane over the dappled green Midwestern afternoon. Time seemed, as it always does in adulthood after a particular stretch has concluded, no matter how ponderous or unpleasant the stretch was to endure, to have passed quickly indeed. Part 2 Chapter 112 Riding in a taxi from Houston's George Bush Intercontinental Airport to her downtown hotel, Liz called Jane's cell phone. When her sister answered, Liz blurted out, "Jane, I had sex with Darcy 4 times, and this morning he came to Kitty and Mary's apartment and said he's in love with me." "Are you serious? I was in my pajamas and didn't even have a bra on." "What did you tell him?" "What do you think I told him? He's crazy." Jane was quiet before saying, "Maybe he's not as bad as we thought. If he recognizes how special you are." "Actually, he told me I'm not beautiful, I'm not funny, I'm gossipy, and he can't stand Mom. This is during his declaration of love. But I still don't think he could imagine any woman, including me, turning down the chance to be his girlfriend." "Poor guy." "We're talking about the person who came between you and Chip. But think how infatuated with you he must be to swallow his pride, which we all know he has lots of. Do you remember that conversation you and I had at Chip's dinner party about how he'd bought a mountain bike for you and you didn't know if you should accept it? Apparently, Darcy overheard us and took your hesitation about the bike as hesitation about Chip in general."
"I can understand that."
"Aren't you mad? Darcy's given me grief for eavesdropping, but at least I do it competently."
"Lizzie,
I did have reservations about Chip. I expressed them to you more than once. I liked him a lot, but...
Jane paused. The whole time I was with Chip, I wasn't sure that I was pregnant, but I wasn't sure I wasn't.
I have something weird to tell you about Jasper, too, Liz said.
Have you guys been in touch?
Not really.
He had sent two more texts, neither of which Liz had answered. The first had been another link, this one to a list of unintentionally funny newspaper headlines. And the second had said, "Are you ignoring me?"
I didn't know it until recently, Liz said. But Jasper got expelled from Stanford a few weeks before he was supposed to graduate. Jasper and Darcy were in the same class, and even though Jasper had never mentioned his expulsion, he did admit that it had happened. But the story he told me and the story Darcy told me only sort of match up. Basically, according to Darcy, Jasper was kicked out for...
Liz hesitated out of concern for the taxi driver, who, if listening, had already learned an unseemly amount about her in a few minutes. But really, there were few ways of accurately describing the act.
For peeing on the desk of his creative writing professor, she continued. And the professor was a black woman.
He peed? Jane said. As in going to the bathroom?
Yes, Liz said. That kind of pee.
On her desk?
Yes, Liz said. On the desk in her apartment.
That's the strangest thing I've ever heard, Jane said.
It's gross, right? Even if he was 22 at the time and drunk, there's no way it's not gross.
Darcy also said Jasper never got a degree.
Does that mean he's lied to every employer he's ever had? It makes it even weirder that he wears that Stanford ring.
Does he? Jane said. I hadn't noticed.
It's gold. I've always thought it looks like what a bond trader from New Jersey would have worn in the 1980s.
Did Darcy make up the story about Jasper because he's jealous?
No, I trust Darcy.
The statement felt odd.
But if Jasper peed on his professor's desk, was he standing, or did he go in a jar, then pour it out?
Oh, Lizzie!
And was it spontaneous? Like, he has to take a leak and thinks, I'll do it on her desk? Or did he decide ahead of time?
Jasper has always seemed like a complicated person.
That's generous.
Out the window of Liz's taxi, the other lanes of the highway were packed with cars. To her right, the sun was setting and the sky was tinged pink.
Anyway, she said, how are you?
I'm good, Jane said. I met with a doctor today, and she was really nice. Was it sad leaving Cincinnati? Liz thought of her final view of the Tudor, when the tenting had been almost complete. The tarps Ken Weinrich's crew used had yellow and royal blue stripes, not unlike those for a circus. And this had lent a festive yet undignified mood to the proceedings. Then she thought of Darcy standing just outside her sister's apartment in his scrubs.
It wasn't sad, exactly, Liz said.
But it was different from what I'd expected.
Chapter 113.
Though Liz sometimes went along with the pretense that interviewing celebrities was glamorous, the truth was that she rarely enjoyed it. Arranging the interviews through the celebrity's publicist and the publicist's assistant was always onerous, with frequent cancellations or time changes. During the interviews, celebrities often responded to questions using answers they had given before, which meant Liz's editor wouldn't want them included. Publicists tended to sit in, chaperone-like, on the interviews, thereby dissuading the celebrity from saying anything ostensibly off-topic, and a general air of urgency attended the encounters, as if the celebrities were heads of state managing a nuclear threat rather than, as was usually the case,
good-looking people who appeared on screen in fictitious stories. Additionally, Liz always worried that her digital recorders, with celebrities she used too, would fail her. These interviews were stressful then, without necessarily being interesting. At the same time, and Liz had found this assertion to be displeasing to some people who were not famous, such as her own younger sisters, most celebrities were charismatic, intelligent, and warm. Lydia, Kitty, Mary, and indeed much of the general population clearly wished to hear that celebrities were, in person, rude or moronic or not that attractive. But this had rarely been Liz's experience. Publicists were frequently rude, and celebrities almost never were. Also, the celebrities usually were more beautiful in the flesh, emitting a certain glow that made their fame seem inevitable. That Kathy DeBerg, while 80 years old and not a Hollywood starlet, possessed this glow was evident to Liz even from halfway back in the vast hotel ballroom where the National Society of Women in Finance keynote speech occurred. The speech began at 1:15 in the afternoon, before an audience of 2,000. No more than a dozen of them, by Liz's calculation, were men. Two large screens on either side of the stage projected Kathy DeBerg's image to all corners of the room. And in the first few seconds after Kathy DeBerg was introduced, Liz noted that she had had Botox, as well as dermal fillers. Though after that, it was Kathy DeBerg's poise and the substance of her speech that Liz focused on. Because Liz had read Revolutions and Rebellions, as well as Kathy DeBerg's subsequent book of essays and her memoir, much of the advice she dispensed and some of the personal anecdotes she shared were familiar. But her crisp and energetic delivery made everything fresh. Whether citing statistics about the dearth of women in professional leadership roles or recommending the steps individual women could take to command authority, she showed confidence and good humor. Being an icon, it seemed, agreed with her. At the speech's conclusion, Liz waited in her chair in the ballroom, as directed to do via a text that morning from Kathy DeBerg's publicist, Valerie. After 8 minutes, Valerie texted to say Kathy DeBerg was on a call, but Liz would be escorted to the green room imminently. And then, as they had many times already in the last 30 hours, Darcy's remarks outside her sister's apartment came back to her.
"I'm in love with you. I can't stop thinking about you."
Yes, his confession had contained multiple slights, but those words had flanked them. To recall such declarations was marvelously bothersome. It was vexing and delectable.
"I'm in love with you. I can't stop thinking about you."
They made her feel as if her heart were releasing lava. She had planned to blithely leave Darcy behind, but it seemed now that matters between them were unresolved. What it was that needed to be settled, however, what she might convey to him, continued to elude her. Surely it was related to the indifference to his feelings, the defiance, even, that she'd demonstrated during their final conversation. If on certain topics he'd shown insensitivity, she'd concluded that his misbehavior had been of a less egregious variety than her own. She also couldn't help wondering, was he still in love with her? Had her hostile response immediately nullified his desire? Really, how could it not have? "Liz?" Approaching from a door near the stage was a young woman in a charcoal pantsuit. "I'm Valerie Wright. Kathy DeBerg is ready to see you." Chapter 114. In the green room, Kathy DeBerg was eating an arugula salad. She stood to firmly shake Liz's hand and said, "I apologize for keeping you waiting, but my dog has keratitis and I was touching base with the vet."
"I'm so sorry," Liz said.
She knew that Kathy DeBerg was the owner of a Pekingese named Button, though Liz did not mention this knowledge because of the fine line between due diligence and creepiness. As they sat, Kathy DeBerg smiled and said, "Now that we've both apologized within the first 30 seconds of our conversation about women and power, shall we begin?"
While Liz set her two digital recorders on the glass tabletop and turned them on, Kathy DeBerg added,
"You might not know this, but I myself was once a writer for Mascara."
"Oh, it's one of our claims to fame," Liz said. She was reassured that Kathy DeBerg knew what publication she was being interviewed for. Regularly, very famous people didn't.
"That was roughly 15,000 years ago," Kathy DeBerg said, "during the Pleistocene epoch."
Liz said, "Knowing you'd worked for the magazine was the main reason I was excited to get a job there."
Kathy DeBerg laughed. "Liz, flattery will get you everywhere."
As Valerie Wright and two other women whose identities never became clear to Liz sat in chairs against the wall and typed on their smartphones, Liz asked Kathy DeBerg about feminism's present and past, about whether its current prominence in popular culture struck her as meaningful or fleeting, about reproductive freedom and equal compensation, race and gender, mentoring, ambition, likability, and whether having it all was a realistic possibility or a phrase that ought to be expurgated from the English language. Usually in interviews, every few minutes the subject would say something articulate or insightful enough that Liz knew she could use it in her article, and she'd feel a little lift or maybe relief. With Kathy DeBerg, every sentence of every answer was usable, and the responses weren't all ones Liz had heard before. As they reached the end of the allotted 20 minutes, which Liz had high hopes of exceeding, she said, "You didn't marry until you were 67 years old. Was that due to the difficulty of finding a spouse who would treat you as an equal partner?" Kathy DeBerg smiled again.
"Are you married?" she asked.
"A2, Kathy DeBerg?" Liz thought and shook her head. She knew that Kathy DeBerg's husband, a renowned architect, had died of an aneurysm only 3 years after their wedding.
"I considered getting married many times," Kathy DeBerg said. "I certainly had my share of suitors. But..."
She paused.
"How can I describe this?"
Liz remained quiet. Remaining quiet was the most reliable tool in her interviewing kit. And Kathy DeBerg said,
"With all the men I dated before Benjamin, there was some degree of performance involved. Even when those men and I had a lot of chemistry, or maybe especially then, it was like we were performing our chemistry either for an audience or just for each other. I was engaged once to a very good-looking man."
"Indeed," Liz thought, "to the Attorney General of New York."
"But eventually I realized that when I was with him, I was always trying to present the most cheerful, entertaining, attractive version of myself, instead of just being myself. It was a lot of effort, especially over time. Whereas with Benjamin, it never felt like people saw us as a golden couple. And it wasn't how we saw ourselves. We knew each other for 10 years before we became involved. During that time, I gradually realized he was easy to be around and easy to talk to. We once traveled together to China as part of a delegation, not just us, but about 20 people. And even when the bus was late or our luggage got lost, he was very unflappable, very considerate of others. That probably doesn't sound romantic, does it? It was real, though. We got a clear view of each other. Whereas when I dated other men, whether it was leading protests or attending parties at the White House, there was a fantasy aspect to our time together that I don't think prepared us for some of the mundane daily struggles life has in store." As Kathy DeBerg took a sip of water, Liz said, "So the lesson is..." Kathy DeBerg set her glass down. "Benjamin was very nurturing. By which I don't mean that he talked extensively about his feelings. He didn't. But he looked out for me in a steady, ongoing way. And I hope I did the same for him. Kathy, you have a 3 o'clock with George Schiff," Valerie Wright said, standing. "Liz, we need to wrap it up. So glad we could make this happen."
Ignoring Valerie, Kathy DeBerg said, "There's a belief that to take care of someone else, or to let someone else take care of you, that both are inherently unfeminist. I don't agree. There's no shame in devoting yourself to another person, as long as he devotes himself to you in return."
Within 30 seconds, Liz knew, she'd be back on the other side of the green room door. She reached for her recorders but didn't turn them off, in case Kathy DeBerg was about to share any final pearls of wisdom. Instead, Kathy DeBerg hugged her, and Liz tried to think who in her life liked her enough that Liz could later make them listen to the barely audible rustle of being embraced by the leader of second-wave feminism. Jane would listen to humor, Liz, though she wouldn't really be interested.
"Be well," Kathy DeBerg said.
Chapter 115.
"Wow,"
Jasper said when Liz answered her cell phone.
"I'm pleasantly surprised you picked up."
It was evening, and Liz was lying in her hotel room bed in Houston, watching a mediocre movie she'd seen in the theater in high school, and thinking,
"I'm in love with you. I can't stop thinking about you."
She said to Jasper, "Did you pee on your writing professor's desk?" The silence that followed. It lasted for more time than would have been necessary to express reflexive bewilderment. At last, Jasper said,
"I assume Darcy has been putting poison in your ear again."
"I have a right to know what really happened."
"If I could go back in time, are there things I'd do differently without question?"
"What made you think that was okay?"
"Besides 10 beers?
Jasper seemed to be waiting for her to laugh, and when she didn't, he said,
"It was stupid and juvenile. There's no denying that. But I swear it wasn't racist. Trisha Randolph could have been blue, green, or polka-dotted, and I would have disliked her just the same."
Jasper was reminding her of someone, Liz thought. And after a second, she realized it was her mother. She said, "Did you ruin the professor's computer? You must have." Jasper said nothing. And Liz added, "I can't believe you peed on a writer's computer."
"Don't tell me you never did anything dumb when you were 22.
"I loved you so much." Liz didn't raise her voice. She felt more sad than outraged. "From the time we met, I would have done anything for you. I thought you were so smart and cute and funny, and I was so flattered that you respected me and wanted to be friends. But how could you have strung me along all these years? If my excuse is a misguided crush, what's yours?"
"Nin,"
Jasper said, and his pained tone was a reminder that however he had transgressed, he hadn't done so entirely callously. His affection for her was not fake. It was just partial. Or perhaps it was fake. He was faking emotion now, and he had a personality disorder. But between these possibilities, she preferred to see him as inadequate rather than clinically diagnosable.
"I'm going to do better," he said. "Starting now, I'm getting my act together. Don't give up on me."
"Oh, Jasper," Liz said. "I already have." Chapter 116. She had been asleep for less than an hour when her cell phone rang again, and the sound of it in the dark, in a hotel room late at night, was sufficiently unsettling that she answered before even looking at the caller ID to make sure it wasn't Jasper again.
"I woke you up," said a female voice. "Sorry, I'll call back tomorrow."
It wasn't Jane. That was the fact Liz was certain of first. But several additional seconds passed before her brain determined who it was.
"Charlotte," she said. "Hi. It's fine. I'm awake."
And then Charlotte Lucas began to sob. And between gulps, she said,
"You told me so. You told me, but I moved here anyway like an idiot."
"Hold on," Liz said. "Slow down. Where are you?"
"I'm at the house. His house."
"You're not... He isn't, like, abusive, is he?" Charlotte sniffled lavishly.
"No, he's not abusive. Well, he's a sweet, self-centered dork."
"Is he with you right now?"
"He's at work, where he always is."
Liz could hear Charlotte swallow, and she sounded slightly calmer when she next spoke.
"I'm so dumb."
"Did something happen?"
"I moved to a state where I don't know anyone," Charlotte said, "including my own boyfriend. That's what happened."
"But did something specific happen? Have you been feeling this way all along?"
"I got a job offer,"
Charlotte said, and Liz said, "That's great."
"You'd think. It's a good job, too, with a data analytics company that expects to triple in size in the next year. I had a bunch of interviews, but nothing panned out until I got the offer this afternoon. And somehow, it made it all real. I've been taking it easy, like going to the gym for an hour and a half in the middle of the day and cooking fancy recipes that we eat at 10 o'clock at night. But if I take this job, it means I'm no longer playing house, impersonating a good little 1950s homemaker. I'll really live out here long term with Willie."
"Do you not want that?"
"I don't know what I want," Charlotte wailed. "Maybe instead of taking the job, I should get pregnant now. And that way, even if Willie and I break up, I'll still be a mom."
"I can see how this feels overwhelming," Liz said. "But I think you're conflating separate issues."
"Have I mentioned that Willie snores like a freight train? And I lie there thinking, okay, if I dated him for 2 years before we moved in together like normal people do, or even for 6 months, I'd have gotten used to this. Or I'd be deeply in love with him and be like, oh, the endearing foibles of my darling boyfriend. Instead, I feel like I'm a mail-order bride and he's an annoying stranger robbing me of sleep."
"Nobody thinks snoring is endearing," Liz said. "Does he know he does it?"
"I have no idea."
"Ask him. If he doesn't know, he should see a doctor in case he has breathing problems. Aren't there special pillows you can buy? But the bigger question is whether you want to make it work. If you'd rather get on a plane and go back to Cincinnati, you're allowed to. I'll bet Proctor would hire you again in a heartbeat."
"If I pay for your ticket, will you come out here and tell me what to do with my life?"
"Now?"
"Do you have plans for Labor Day weekend? You're still in Cincinnati, right?"
"I'm in Houston. I interviewed Kathy DeBerg, who was giving a speech here today, and I was planning to go back to New York in the morning."
"Kathy DeBerg? Oh my God! Was she awesome?"
"Yes," Liz said. "She actually was."
"I know I'm asking a lot," Charlotte said, "but I just need someone else's perspective, someone who knows me well. We have a guest room."
The thought of staying in Willie's house after their last interaction was not enticing to Liz. But she said, "I'll look at flights after we get off the phone. But promise me one thing. Go to a drugstore right now and get earplugs. Or sleep in a different room tonight."
"Earplugs aren't a bad idea," Charlotte said.
"Sleep deprivation makes other problems so much worse."
"You're right. See how crazy I've become? I can't even manage basic self-care.
You're being too hard on yourself. Just buy some earplugs, relax, and I'll be there tomorrow.
Thank you, Lizzie, Charlotte said. I really appreciate this.
By the way, if you're worried about things being awkward with Willie, awkwardness doesn't register with him.
That almost makes me jealous, Liz said.
I know, Charlotte said. No kidding.
Chapter 117. Waiting in the security line back at Houston's George Bush Intercontinental Airport, Liz found herself indulging in a pointless and perhaps even masochistic imaginative exercise about what it would be like if Darcy were her boyfriend. Given his job, she would need to move to Cincinnati, a possibility that in theory would have seemed distinctly unappealing, if not outright prohibitive, but for the reason in question, struck her as potentially manageable. Indeed, the proximity to her family, were she to establish her own life rather than simply facilitate theirs, might be a boon. She could help her parents settle into a new dwelling, keep a closer eye on their finances, and perhaps develop adult relationships with Mary, Kitty, and Lydia. Or maybe that was delusional, no matter the circumstances. Convincing Talia to allow her to work permanently from Cincinnati would be a challenge, but presumably a juicy profile of Kathy DeBerg would put Liz's editor in a magnanimous mood. Then, of course, there was the matter of Darcy himself, of sharing his bed not just for 15 sweaty minutes at a time, but for entire nights, of enjoying the confidence that he was glad she was there, which is such an oddly luxurious notion that it made her feel both swoony and heartbroken. The thought of him as the person with whom she partook of ordinary daily activities, eating soup and grilled cheese together for lunch on a winter Saturday, watching TV dramas or political talk shows at night, holding a palm to each other's forehead, or picking up cold medicine when one of them wondered if they were sick, seemed almost inconceivably bizarre. And yet it also filled her with a tender sort of yearning. If they lived together, she decided as she handed her ticket to the agent at the gate and boarded a plane not to New York but to San Francisco, they'd need to move to a bigger apartment, or even a house, so that she could have an office. Though her interest in decor was limited, certainly in comparison to her mother's, she didn't think it would hurt to hang a print or two on the walls and acquire a plant. Except, of course, that none of this would come to pass. Surely she had destroyed any such eventualities by treating him with rash and unrepentant rudeness. Surely his attraction to her had been rescinded. As it happened, she still possessed neither his phone number nor his email nor even his street address. On all the occasions on which she'd visited his apartment, she'd been more preoccupied with impending events than with the numerals by which his building was identified. But in this day and age, it couldn't be difficult to track him down electronically. She could probably find his email on the University of Cincinnati website. And yet, there remained the question of what Liz would say. "I'm sorry" seemed the most obvious option. But perhaps, "Hey, how's it going?" was a more casual opener. Out Liz's plane window, the mountains of northwest Utah were snow-peaked and lunar, even in August. Too preoccupied to read, Liz scrutinized them at length. But they offered no sagacity. At last, she leaned back in her seat and closed her eyes. Chapter 118. Upon landing in San Francisco, Liz called Ken Weinrich to find out if the fumigation had concluded successfully, and he confirmed that the sulfuryl fluoride levels inside the house had measured at below 5 parts per million, he had seen no spiders, and his team had removed the tent and fans. Liz then called Mary's cell phone, though it was difficult to hear Mary over the sound of their mother shouting in the background. Apparently,
They were back at the Tudor in the kitchen.
"That food was all perfectly good," Mrs. Bennet was declaring. "Why, I hadn't even opened Bev Wattenberg's peach marmalade."
"Tell her I'm sure the Wattenbergs will give us more marmalade at Christmas," Liz said. And Mary said, "There's no point."
"The house doesn't smell weird at all?" Liz asked.
"It doesn't smell like anything," Mary said.
"I'll tell you who won't appreciate my tins of smoked trout," Mrs. Bennet was shouting, "and that's a hobo at a shelter."
"I have to go," Mary said. "Hang in there," Liz said, and Mary said in a churlish tone, "Thanks for the long-distance pep talk."
Chapter 119. Outside the Delta terminal at SFO, Charlotte appeared considerably more tranquil than Liz had expected. This tranquility was reassuring while casting doubt on the necessity of Liz's presence. But if now they were friends again, then what else mattered?
"Earplugs are the best invention ever," Charlotte said as she merged into the left lane. "I slept for 11 hours last night."
"Congratulations. Want to go with me to Nordstrom to buy new work clothes?"
"Does that mean you accepted the job?"
"I called them right before I got in the car to pick you up. I start a week from Labor Day."
"That's great, Charlotte. And I'd be honored to go to Nordstrom with you."
With traffic, it took them almost an hour to reach the Stanford Shopping Center in Palo Alto. They ate lunch at a restaurant before entering the department store.
"Everyone says how casual it is out here, but that's if you're a 25-year-old dude," Charlotte said as she sorted through a rack of plus-size tops.
Inspecting a bra in the adjacent lingerie section, Liz thought, "Would he like this or find it cheesy?" With a jolt, she realized that the he in question, for the first time in a long while, was not Jasper.
"I'm trying these."
Charlotte held up three hangers, then nodded her chin toward the bra.
"Va-va-va-voom!"
"It's expensive."
Charlotte looked skeptical.
"For a New Yorker?"
Liz held out the price tag, which read $200.
"There's no better investment than your cleavage,"
Charlotte smirked. "I believe they teach that in business school." 70 minutes later, they were in the mall parking lot, walking back toward Charlotte's car with their respective purchases. Liz could not possibly justify buying the bra, and it was in her bag, when Liz said,
"So I broke up with Jasper."
"Are you bummed or relieved?"
"Somewhere in between.
Mostly I feel stupid for not realizing until now how obnoxious he is, when other people have seen it all along."
"You were really young when you met him," Charlotte said.
"That should give you some exemption."
As she pressed her key to unlock the car, she said, "This morning, Willie made an appointment with an ENT doctor. It turns out he had no idea that he snores."
"I guess if you've never had a girlfriend, no one's ever told you."
Whether or not it was completely true, Liz was compelled to say,
"For the record, I like Willie. I think he's a good guy."
Wryly, but not angrily, Charlotte said, "Which is why you were disgusted when he tried to kiss you?"
Liz was on the cusp of saying, "He's my cousin," when Charlotte added, "And don't say it's because you're cousins. We both know you'd have been disgusted no matter what."
"But that's okay."
"I just don't think he and I had chemistry," Liz said, and Charlotte smiled.
"I hope it's all right that I invited your aunt and uncle for dinner tonight."
"Perfect," Liz said.
She had arranged to stay in the Bay Area for 3 days, then fly to New York on a red eye. She said to Charlotte, "If you want to take a nap this afternoon, I'm happy to go grocery shopping, or whatever errands you need. My errand running muscles have gotten pretty huge this summer." They had set their bags in the trunk of the car and climbed into the front seat, and Charlotte said,
It's not that I haven't had a bumpy adjustment out here. But I did call you at a low moment last night. Let's do something fun. Have you ever seen the campus of Stanford?
Your life changed a lot all at once, Liz said. It would be weird if you didn't have second thoughts.
And no, I've never seen Stanford. Although, how could touring the university make her think of anything except what Jasper had done to his creative writing instructor?
You know what else is around here? Is Darcy's family's estate.
Charlotte laughed. His estate? Who is he? The King of England?
It's somewhere in Atherton, Liz said.
Okay, don't judge me, but Darcy and I slept together a few times.
Charlotte made a joyous whoop.
I knew you two were flirting at Chip's dinner party.
That's right, Liz said. You did call that, didn't you?
A few times? If you kept going back for more, I take it the sex was halfway decent.
Yes, Liz said. You could say so.
I don't suppose you know the address of this estate.
As Liz pulled out her phone, her heart thudded. She typed, Darcy Estate, Atherton. And a few clicks later, she said, 1813 Pemberley Lane. You take Sand Hill Road to El Camino Real.
In a phonally high voice, Charlotte said,
I think Darcy grew up around here. What? Go look at it. No, innocent little me. Why, I wouldn't dream of it.
12 minutes later, Charlotte was making a right from El Camino Real into a residential neighborhood blocked off from the more trafficked throughway by a tall, ivy-colored wall. On either side of the entry to the quieter street hung signs that read, No trespassing. Residents only.
I'd rather not get arrested, Liz said. I realize we're here because of me, but I'll just put that out there.
Is the woman who went alone to Saudi Arabia chickening out?
I'm not pretending that I'm not interested, Liz said. It's just that, holy shit, is that it?
A wrought iron fence that was easily 8 feet high enclosed a massive verdant lawn on which trees and a combination of modern and older sculptures stood at intervals. As Charlotte continued driving, they reached the fence's gate, which was closed. Beyond it, a long gravel driveway led to a brick mansion that in its grandness and symmetry evoked a southern plantation. Charlotte pointed through the gate to a larger-than-life bronze statue of a nude male.
You think Darcy posed for that?
No one lives in the house, Liz said. Darcy's parents have died, and his sister is a grad student at Stanford. But can you imagine how...
The thought went unexpressed. It was at this moment that a black van with tinted windows approached from the opposite direction and stopped next to them, its driver's side window descending. A middle-aged man with a crew cut said in a brisk tone,
Can I help you, ladies?
We're friends of the family who owns this place, Charlotte said. Friends of Fitzwilliam Darcy. The man appraised Charlotte, then Liz.
Is one of you Caroline Bingley?
This wasn't what Liz had expected him to ask. And if she'd thought the situation through, she'd never have uttered what she did next. But she did not think it through. Instead, she raised her hand and said,
I am.
The man's demeanor became marginally friendlier. He said,
Just a minute.
He held a phone to his ear, but before they could hear him say anything, his window rose. Charlotte turned and whispered excitedly,
We're on a caper. What's wrong with me? Liz said. Why did I tell him that?
The tinted window descended again, and the man said,
Fitzwilliam will meet us in front of the main house. Follow me.
By some invisible mechanism, the hulking doors of the gate opened, and the man drove through.
Let's get out of here, Liz said.
I thought Darcy was in Cincinnati, Charlotte said.
So did I.
Panic was quickly overtaking Liz. As Charlotte turned left up the driveway behind the van, Liz said,
What are you doing?
I'm not leading that guy on a chase. What if he has a gun?
Charlotte, we can't see Darcy. Stop the car. Let me out.
What are you worried about? You and Darcy know each other biblically now.
He'll think we're stalking him. Charlotte, right before I left Cincinnati, Darcy told me he was in love with me. Except in this completely weird, unfriendly way, and I was really rude back to him. And the whole thing was bizarre.
Charlotte laughed. Liz Bennett, you seductress. Is there any man who hasn't fallen for you this summer? Besides, we are stalking him, or at least his land.
In front of the house did not seem an adequate descriptor for the gargantuan structure before them. Near the steps leading to an enormous front door was a figure that even from a distance of 20 yards, Liz could tell was Darcy. She thought of the two of them writhing in the bed in his apartment and felt a multifaceted confusion. Near Darcy, the black van made a U-turn and continued back down the driveway the way they'd come. Charlotte stopped in front of the steps and without warning automatically lowered Liz's window. Darcy walked closer to them, and by the time he recoiled, in surprise, Liz hoped, rather than revulsion, he was truly upon them.
Liz?
He looked shocked.
Charlotte leaned forward and waved.
Hi, Darcy.
Charlotte?
Liz heard Charlotte say,
We were in the area.
And it was impossible not to believe that her friend was relishing this encounter.
That guy, Liz said, your bodyguard or whatever? He assumed I was Caroline Bingley, but I'm not.
No, Darcy said, you're not.
He didn't, as Liz had feared, seem angry. He still seemed simply puzzled.
I thought you'd gone back to New York.
I came to visit Charlotte.
Darcy glanced at Charlotte.
I understand you've become a Californian.
Who'd have thunk, huh?
Charlotte said.
Why are you here?
Liz asked Darcy.
At my own house, do you mean?
But Darcy sounded warm, not mocking. Indeed, he seemed to Liz warmer than he ever had in Cincinnati, though perhaps the difference was less his affect than her perception of it.
Georgie and I hold a Labor Day get-together every year, he was saying. Or we host it the years I don't have to work. That's why Roger confused you with Caroline Bingley. She's due here tomorrow.
Liz tried not to demonstrably register this troubling bit of news, and instead strove to sound pleasant and breezy.
With Chip?
She asked.
Darcy shook his head. No, he's still filming. But a few of our classmates from med school are coming from San Francisco. And some friends of Georgie's.
Darcy looked between Liz and Charlotte.
As long as you're here, would you two like to see the house?
We're actually, Liz began, and Charlotte said, We'd love to.
As Charlotte turned off the engine, Darcy said,
I hope Roger wasn't rude. He's the caretaker, not my bodyguard. But he can be overzealous, because we sometimes get people snooping around the property.
Chapter 120 For once, Liz wouldn't have asked, but Charlotte did, in a way that somehow seemed as neutral a question a person might pose about an exhibit in a museum, and Darcy answered in kind. The main house at Pemberley was 19,000 square feet and contained 12 bedrooms and 17 bathrooms. There also was a guest house, a caretaker's cottage, and a currently unused stable. They entered through the foyer, made a right into a hallway with a high arched ceiling, made another right, and found themselves in a ballroom, a vast space with a walnut floor. Mostly empty save for two spectacular crystal chandeliers, matching marble fireplaces at either end of the room,
and a half-dozen murals featuring scenes from what Darcy identified as England's Lake District. He said,
I suspect that my great-great-grandfather thought a veneer of British elegance would distract from his having run away from his home in rural Virginia at the age of 13.
Rags to riches, Charlotte said. And Liz said,
So Pemberley has been in your family all this time?
Which is why my sister fears that we'll be letting down all our ancestors by donating it to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Whereas I think the opposite. Neither Georgie nor I will ever have a family big enough to justify this kind of space. Nobody has a family big enough.
They walked from the ballroom into a trophy room, then an oak-paneled study with an oil painting over the fireplace of a balding, somber man wearing a black tie, a white shirt with an upturned collar, a black waistcoat, a black jacket, and a pocket watch whose gold chain was visible.
That's the original Fitzwilliam Darcy, my great-great-grandfather,
Darcy said.
He started building Pemberley in 1915, by which point he'd established himself as a railroad and borax mining magnate. I'm sure you've heard the saying about every fortune being built on a great crime.
Liz, who had spoken little since entering the house, tried to sound normal as she asked, Should I pretend to know what borax is?
Charlotte, I bet you know from Procter & Gamble.
To Liz, Darcy said,
Sodium borate, a compound that's in everything from detergent to fiberglass.
They were in the library, where scores of leather-bound books sat on built-in shelves,